Hello, everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, we first go to the Netherlands, where General Electric is setting off a renewable energy arms race. Twirling above a strip of land at the mouth of Rotterdam's harbor is a wind turbine so large it is difficult to photograph. The turning diameter of its rotor is longer than two American football fields end to end. Later models will be taller than any building on the mainland of Western Europe. Packed with sensors, which gather data on wind speeds, electricity output, and stresses on its components, the giant whirling machine in the Netherlands is a test model for a new series of giant offshore wind turbines that are planned by General Electric. When assembled in arrays, the wind machines have the potential to power cities, supplanting the emissions spewing coal or natural gas-fired plants that now form the backbones of many electric systems today. GE has yet to install one of these machines in ocean water. As a relative newcomer to the offshore wind business, the company faces questions about how quickly and how efficiently it can scale up production to build and to install hundreds of these turbines. But already the giant turbines have turned heads in the industry, and a top executive at the world's leading wind farm developer called it a bit of leapfrog over the latest technology. And an industry analyst said that the machine size and advanced sales had shaken the industry to its very foundations. The prototype is the first of a generation of new wind machines that are about to be more powerful than the largest already in commercial service. As such, it is changing the business calculations of wind equipment makers, developers, and investors. The GE machines will have a generating capacity that would have been almost unimaginable a decade ago. A single one will be able to turn out 13 megawatts of power, and that's enough to light up a town of roughly 12,000 homes. The turbine, which is capable of producing as much thrust as the four engines of a Boeing 747 jet, according to GE, will be deployed at sea, where developers have learned that they can plant larger and more numerous turbines than on land in order to capture breezes that are stronger and more reliable. Offshore technology took hold in Northern Europe in the last three decades and is now spreading to the east coast of the United States as well as to Asia, including Taiwan, China, and South Korea. The big ticket projects, which cost billions of dollars, that are possible now at sea, are attracting large investors, including oil companies like British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell. They want to quickly enhance their green energy offerings and are going to be players in this game as well. And now, from wind turbines, we're going to continue with some atmospheric information today. This is a make or break year for climate action. The year 2021 is shaping up as a make or break moment in the fight to curb climate change. Very few world leaders now doubt the scale of this problem. They have vivid memories of last year's record heat waves, ice melts, wildfires, and hurricanes. And now they have new scientific reports that global warming is still gathering pace. The world's key economic powers, that is, the European Union, China, and the United States, under the new Biden administration, have all announced more ambitious goals to limit reliance on fossil fuels. The linchpin question is, though, will world leaders exhibit the political will to translate their words into action? There are two litmus tests that bear watching in this regard. Politically, in the run-up to a global climate summit next November, will governments approach climate action as a genuine emergency? And economically, how green will their priorities really be when it comes to investing in their post-pandemic recovery programs? Both of these are distinctly 2021 challenges. The November conference in the Scottish city of Glasgow will come 6 years after the last major international step toward fighting global warming, that was in the Paris Climate Agreement. In Paris, every nation, including the world's two worst carbon emitters, China and the United States, pledged to take measures to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, with the goal of keeping global temperature at most 2 degrees Celsius higher than pre-industrial revolution levels, and preferably only 1.5 higher. The deal was seen as a turning point at the time, but over the past 5 years, not only have the signatories' national commitments proved insufficient to put a brake on global warming, but the United States announced it was pulling out of the treaty. According to data published in recent days, 2020 and 2016 were the hottest years since the first reliable records over a century ago. And the global temperature increase since the 1800s now stands at 1.2 centigrade, not far below the limit aspired to in Paris. In December, the United Nations predicted that figure would reach 3.2 Celsius or centigrade by the end of the century, unless countries do far more than they are now to address global climate change. Let's see if these goals can be met. And now, we'll take a short break while you listen to some music. Enjoy. Did you know that the murder rate is increasing at an unprecedented pace? Is it a blip? Well, overall crime has dropped dramatically in the United States since the late 1990s. But 2020 homicide rate exceeds the rate of the late 80s and 90s before the big drop, according to Richard Rosenfeld, who is lead author of a new paper called Pandemic, Social Unrest and Crime in U.S. Cities. This round of crime increase is totally unprecedented. In 2020, 51 cities across the U.S. saw an average 35% jump in murder from 2019. A historically awful development, says New Orleans-based crime analyst Jeff Asher, who crunched those numbers. A different study looking at 21 U.S. cities found 610 more murders in those jurisdictions in 2020 over the year prior. In those cities, gun assaults increased by 10% over 2019. Those who want to read partisanship into the trend will be disappointed. Like the pandemic, murder doesn't discriminate by political affiliation. When society's norms and values are in flux, or have disappeared or disintegrated, people don't know how to behave, says Kim Davies, who is a sociologist studying the dynamics of violent crime. He says it's a kind of normlessness that gives way to nothing matters. The murder increase is similar to the spikes in suicide when we've had an economic depression, but nothing like this has ever happened. That unique dynamic also gives researchers hope that 2020 becomes a statistical anomaly. If you peruse newspapers outside of the United States and look at the newspapers in Europe and also from countries around the Mediterranean Sea, you would find that the Daily Sabah is a Turkish newspaper. And one of the main articles recently in the Daily Sabah is about Greece's greedy sea grab. Tell you what that means. The Greeks are finally talking to Turkey again about maritime border disputes, but only because they lost their gamble on Libya. Greece and Turkey have been at odds for years over Greece's absurd claim that it controls the entire Aegean Sea and much of the natural gas-rich Eastern Mediterranean. Athens pretends that every tiny Greek island, even a rock just a few miles off the Turkish coast, entitles Greece to an exclusive economic zone in the waters for miles around. And such a policy conveniently forces the containment of Turkey, which has the longest Mediterranean coastline. And it contains Turkey within a small portion of the sea. Well, in 2019, Ankara, that's the capital of Turkey, commented that Athens' maximalist demands by signing an agreement on maritime borders with Libya's United Nations recognized government in Tripoli was time for retaliation. The Greeks retaliated by supporting Libyan rebels led by the warlord General Khalifa Haftar and pinning their hopes on a coup d'etat. Turkey sent troops and other support to bolster Libya's legitimate government. And Haftar's rebellion recently failed. A reluctant Athens has now returned to the negotiating table, but it has increased defense spending fivefold and refuses to discuss its illegal militarization of Aegean islands. So this item is read from the Turkish point of view, but there has been long a disagreement between the two countries with respect to maritime boundaries. We'll hear more about this later on. It doesn't appear in our newspapers now, but be patient. It's going to be there in the Tribune or one of the other papers, the national papers, in the foreign news very soon. Now, a short break while we go to something else. We're going to remain in the Mediterranean area for this next item. It's entitled Inventing the Alphabet. New scholarship points to a paradox of historic scope. Our writing system was devised by people who couldn't read. Centuries before Moses wandered into the great and terrible wilderness of the Sinai Peninsula, this triangle of desert wedged between Africa and Asia attracted speculators drawn by rich mineral deposits which were hidden in the rocks. And it was on one of these expeditions around 4,000 years ago, catch your minds back there, that some mysterious person or group took a bold step that in retrospect was truly revolutionary. Scratched on the wall of a mind is the very first attempt at something we use every day, the alphabet. The evidence, which continues to be examined and reinterpreted 116 years after its discovery, is on a windswept plateau in Egypt called Serabit El Kadim, a remote spot even by Sinai standards. Yet it wasn't too difficult for even ancient Egyptians to reach, as the presence of a temple right at the top shows. When visited in 2019, the writer of this article looked out over the desolate, beautiful landscape from the summit and realized he was seeing the same view the inventors of the alphabet had seen every day. The temple was built into the living rock dedicated to Hathor, the goddess of turquoise, among many other things. Stelae, chiseled with hieroglyphics, which line the paths to the shrine, where archaeological evidence indicates there was once an extensive temple complex. A mile or so southwest of the temple is the source of an ancient interest in this area, because embedded in the rock are nodules of turquoise, a stone that symbolized rebirth, a vital motif in Egyptian culture, and the color that decorated the walls of their lavish tombs. Turquoise is why Egyptian elites sent expeditions from the mainland here, a project that began 2800 BC. It lasted for over 1,000 years. Expeditions made offerings to Hathor in hopes of a rich haul to take home. And then in 1905, a couple of Egyptologists, Sir William and Hinda Flinders Petrie, first excavated the temple, documenting thousands of votive offerings which were there. The pair also discovered curious signs on the side of a mine and began to notice them elsewhere on walls and small statues. Some signs were clearly related to hieroglyphics, yet they were simpler than the beautiful pictorial Egyptian script on the temple walls. The Flinders Petries recognized the signs as an alphabet, though decoding the letters would take another decade, and tracing the source of the invention was far, far longer. They brought many of the prizes they had unearthed back to London, including a small red sandstone sphinx with the same handful of letters on its side as those seen in the mines. And after 10 years of studying the inscriptions, in 1916, the Egyptologist Sir Alan Gardner published his transcription of the letters and their translation. An inscription on the little sphinx, written in a Semitic dialect, read, "Beloved of Baalat," referring to the Canaanite goddess, the consort of Baal, the powerful Canaanite god. "For me, it's worth all the gold in Egypt," the Israeli Egyptologist Orly Goldwasser said of this little sphinx when it was viewed at the British Museum in late 2018. They'd come to London to be interviewed for a BBC documentary about the history of writing. And in the high-ceilinged Egypt and Sudan study room, which was lined with bookcases, separated from the crowds in the public galleries by locked doors and iron staircases, a curator brought the sphinx out of its basket and placed it on a table where Goldwasser and others marveled at it. Every word we read and wrote started with him and his friends, they explained, how miners on the Sinai Peninsula would have gone about transforming a hieroglyph into a letter. Call the picture by name. Pick up only the first sound and discard the picture from your mind. Thus the hieroglyph for an ox, which was Aleph, helped give a shape to the letter A, while the alphabet's inventors derived B from the hieroglyph for house, which was Het. These first two signs came to form the name of the system itself, the alphabet. Some letters were borrowed from hieroglyphs, others were drawn from life, until all the sounds of the language they spoke could be represented in written form. And so, that is the introduction to a very interesting article in Smithsonian Magazine, February 2021. Entitled Inventing the Alphabet. You might want to look at that later on and finish it yourself. And now we have a little bit of time to talk about words. We've been talking about the alphabet, but if you remember in one of the previous programs, I was talking about words and also words that Shakespeare had introduced. And I will give you this information as we close today. What's the difference between a bibliophile and a bibliophagist? Well, a bibliophile loves the look, the smell, and the aesthetic of books, and may have hundreds of them displayed proudly at home, including several first editions, and may even boast excitedly about loving books. But the bibliophagist is the real deal, because he or she is simply a voracious reader. Which one are you? And now, my friends, until next time, this is Dan Dillman asking you to stay safe, wear your mask. Social distancing now is of the utmost importance. Try to get your shots if you can in your area. Have a good day, my friends. And tune in next time to a little of this, a little of that. Enjoy having you here, and I'll be waiting for you. You tune in to 101.5. And that's all for today. Good day.